it went straight down the middle.
I want to ask you something, Dean, that's come up in several of our interviews, because we've talked to a lot of folks, guys that came over from Australia to play in South Africa and so forth, the UK, and that relates to the experience of the foreign player coming into the PGA Tour back in the early days. Now, you have the player perspective, and you also have sort of the administrator perspective from running the tour. And we've heard the players and their perspectives, but there was obviously some bias against the foreign players back in the early days. You know, what I've gathered, it didn't come from the elite players. They didn't feel threatened, but for the middle rung PGA players who were trying to put bread on the family's table, they felt that these guys were taking money off the table. What's your recollection of that as both player and commissioner?
Well, I think there was some friction about it, no question about it. My view, I viewed very early on golf as a global game. It was a pittance, but we had. Japan was the first place that was really valuable money-wise for the tour. And we had our telecasts. We sold those rights for telecasting in Japan, and it was modest money to start with. But Japan, back in the early 70s, was really growing in golf. It was a big deal in Japan. And I put a series of events together with our players over in Japan and put some matches on, so that we introduced more and more of our players personally to the Japanese audience, and those rights fees grew exponentially, very, very quickly, and so I believed immediately that globalization of golf was going to be huge for the future. So we then put together the World Series of Golf that was a four-man exhibition. I converted that to an international event. The World Series of Golf from four players to 30 players right out of the box. And I wanted international players to come here so that they would be renowned when they got home, and build globalization of the PGA Tour, and that was big. That is today huge money, and for instance, today to give you some numbers, if a title sponsor is a U.S. company only and pays $12 million to be a title sponsor to an event, the tour has calculated that that sponsor will get nearly $25 to $30 million in value for that $12 million investment. If it's an international company and has a global outreach, that value almost doubles to $40 million. So somebody puts up $12 million, may get $40 million in value for a $12 million investment. That's how golf has become a global game. So I recognized that very, very early and put together the Kieran Cup, where we had, you had the Ryder Cup. But I wanted the rest of the international players to have this forum that the Ryder Cup had provided for European players and U.S. players. So we put the Kieran Cup on. Then we expanded the World Series of Golf for international players. And then as I was getting ready to retire, I was convinced, and I tried to convince the PGA of America to take the Ryder Cup and share it with us and have it the U.S., Europe, and the rest of the world. They would not do that. They wanted it themselves. So I created the President's Cup, which gives the international players a forum and also gives the opportunity for the PGA Tour to expand itself worldwide. So this was all part of my vision of where golf could go. It wasn't just a U.S. little, it wasn't just a series of little U.S. Events in Memphis and Hartford and Chicago or wherever it was. It's a global reach, which you see today.
So for the players that truly wanted to be global players, again, I'm talking back in the early days, there was some built-in conflict then, wasn't there, between the PGA Tour wanting to promote and protect its product and its players and get the best players here as often as they can versus the guy that really did want to play in Asia and Australia and Europe in addition to his U.S. Visits?
There's a balance to that as the communication system, the technology increased, the international values become greater and greater. So we had very little flexibility a long time ago in U.S. players going overseas and playing when in fact we needed them here to make our tournament successful. But as the global reach has expanded, I think the tour is much more lenient and we get value out of our players going internationally to play because part of our huge part of our income comes from that international reach. So we are, again, everybody's winning. The players are winning. The tour is winning by allowing players to be a little more flexible and playing internationally. And the players are winning because they're getting money not only by doing it individually on their own, but when they come back, they're playing for bigger money that we get from international rights fees. So everybody wins.
So let's turn our attention to some of the major challenges you faced in your 20-year term as commissioner, because it always wasn't a bed of roses. We can recite a litany of accomplishments during your tenure, but you also had to deal with some pretty tough issues, didn't you? Why don't you take us through some of the ones that stand out to you?
Well, back early in the early, very early 80s, just as we were had created the brand of the PGA Tour. And that wasn't created until the late 70s, early 80s. Again, the name of the tournament was the Tournament Players Division of the PGA of America. And that's not a really good brand name. So we changed the name to the PGA Tour. Simple. We changed the, looked like a badge, what the logo of the tour was. It looked like the Union Pacific Railroad with a tournament player division on it. And we then created the golfer that you now see as the symbol of the PGA Tour. It was all directed to future marketing, creating a brand, a name brand, and creating a visual brand, so that as that became more and more famous, you could monetize that and add to the other things that television do, to create additional income for the players, so that you could afford to develop the senior tour, so that you could afford to have a pension plan, so that you could afford to have higher prize money for the players. And it was all a long-term strategy to develop golf on a global basis and to develop a marketing and television and marketing strategy that would support all of the things that would benefit the players. It was all about benefiting the players.
you must have faced some tests of the model. I recall vaguely some of the top players threatening to perhaps even go out on their own, create their own deal. Take us through that experience.
Well, early in the 80s, it became a there was a real clash. I can remember it like it was yesterday. The players went to Memorial Tournament in Dublin, Ohio, and out of that came a letter signed by, I believe, 12 or 14 players, led by Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, and Tom Watson, and really led by their managers, okay, that basically said, we do not want the tour to endorse products. We don't want them to own golf courses. We already had the Tournament Players Club, and we're in the process of doing two or three more. We don't want them to own and operate golf courses. We don't want them to have commercial. We want the tour to go back and just run tournaments like Joe Dye did, basically. And they wanted wanted me gone, and they wanted to hire somebody who is great at running tournaments to be the commissioner. So that's what happened. They petitioned the policy board, wrote their name, and signed a letter, and basically said, all this stuff that Beamon's doing, we don't agree with. And that's part of history. That's what happened.
So what was your initial reaction to that letter?
Well, my reaction, first of all, he didn't send the letter to me. They sent it to the chairman of the board, and he then sent a copy to me. I got it secondhand. I looked at it and basically told Dale DeWitt, who was chairman of the board. He was chairman of the board of Eaton Corporation in Cleveland, Ohio, and I told him that I said, this is not a business. We're running it like a business, but this is not a business. The players own the PGA Tour. If this is carried through, the answer is I'm out of here. And I negotiated a deal with Dell. I had 2 years left on my contract, the current contract, maybe three. And I said, the tour does not want tournament players clubs. They don't want the marketing program. They don't like the commercialization of what's happened. I said, if that happens, the answer is we're going to drift back to where the tour was when Joe Dye ran it. I didn't come here to do that. So I built the Tournament Players Club, and I asked the board for my support for doing it. They agreed to let me do it. But they also said they were not going to put a nickel in it. Not $1 will they put in it. So I built the original Tournament Players Club with no money. They didn't put a nickel in it. I said, I will do everything in my power to win this battle. But if we lose this battle, which I want you to know, we need to get lucky to win it. You can have my contract, and I own the Players Club because I built it for nothing. And the tour didn't put it in. They don't want it. I want it. So he agreed to do that. He agreed to give me the Tournament Players Clubs. We had two or three at the time. And I agreed to give my contract for nothing if we lost. Well, Dale said, he says, you know, we can win this. We have corporate battles like this all the time. And I said, this is different. The players aren't minor. The players aren't minor shareholders. They are the tour. They own the tour. So I went back and read the letter a dozen times. And whoever wrote the letter, whether it was Jack Nicklaus's representative or whether it's Arnold's or whether it was Tom Watson's, they made a drastic error in about three words. Because if they'd only said, "We as players do not want you to do this," we would have lost and we wouldn't have been able to do those things. But what they also said was, and added a couple little words that were the lifesaver of the tour today, that we believe you have exceeded your authority by doing what you're doing.
Hmm.
And I said to Dell, I said, "Dell, we haven't exceeded our authority." And I pulled the original papers that were in our archives because they no longer existed because we had abandoned the Delaware Corporation. We were now a nonprofit. I pulled out the original incorporating documents of Delaware that I read in the first 2 months when I wasn't even commissioner and recited to him what those papers said, which was the tour could, it said specifically, own golf courses. It could license. It could sell its name. It could, it was specifically, as every document for a major corporation, it's the broadest thing in the world. Okay? Mm-hmm. You may never do it, but the authorization is there. And lo and behold, do you know whose name was on those papers? Jack Nicklaus was one of the original board members.
Interesting.
So I got Jim Colbert, who was a board member at the time and agreed with what we were doing. I didn't want a personal confrontation with Jack Nicklaus. I got Jimmy Colbert to take those papers and meet with Jack Nicklaus. And it turns out Jack was coming to Washington, D.C. We weren't there anymore. But Jim Colbert got on Jack's airplane with him and sat down with him and said, this is what he told me. He told Jack. He said, "Jack," he said, "we want you to withdraw your letter." And Jack said, "Well, why would I do that?" He said, "Well, because you've impugned the integrity of the commissioner, the entire board, and the corporate executives." And we had some powerful corporate executives. We had the chairman of Merrill Lynch. We had the chairman of Eaton Corporation. We had the chairman of Coca-Cola. We had all these chairmen of major corporations. He said, "Jack, if you don't withdraw your letter, we don't have much money in the till, but we will spend it all to destroy your personal reputation with every corporation in this country, and you'll never get another contract." He said, "Well, why would you do that?" He said, "Because it is authorized. You've impugned their integrity by saying that they have exceeded their authority." And he pulled out the papers and showed them that the written documents, original incorporation in Delaware, provided for all of these. It was not something that was done without authorization. And then went to the last page, and Jack said, "Well, hell, who agreed to this?" And Jimmy Colbert said, "Jack, you did." He said, "What?" And he showed him the name on the written documents. And then that's when Jack went to Arnold and said, "Hey, we got a problem." And they withdraw. We never fought the battle. They withdrew this paper.
You know something, Dean? You guys kept that very, very quiet because this is the very first time that I ever heard anything about that.
Well, that's what happened. That's why they withdrew. They withdrew.
Oh, boy.
They withdrew because Jimmy Colbert threatened Jack and said, we'll do everything we can to restore. I don't think any major corporation will ever put a nickel in your pocket again because you have impugned the integrity of all these people who have served as the board of the PGA Tour, and we've never paid them a nickel. They've done it on their own.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating story, Dean. It is,
Dean.
I suppose, Bruce, the players ought to have a Jimmy Colbert day after hearing this story, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, this is the first time I've ever heard about that. Dean, one question relative to that.
Yeah.
From the day you got that letter until they withdrew, what time frame was that?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Well, Jack's tournament was in May, and the meeting was during Westchester, which would have been late May, early June, maybe just before the U.S. It was only a matter of a couple of weeks.
That's what I figured, because I'll bet 98% of the players knew nothing about this.
Well, we didn't want anybody to know about it.
Right, I know that. I mean, it's remarkable.
Winning that battle, I just want you guys to know, winning that battle cost me about $500 million, because today the Tournament Players have a network of some 30 or 40 golf courses around the world are worth about $500 million.
That's right. And you could have been the owner. Well.
I think you really wanted to win the battle, though.
Oh, yeah. There was no question in my mind that we needed to win that battle.
Yeah.
But nobody knew what Jack's reaction to that would be. Okay?
Yeah.
And not many knew how close the tour as we know it today was teetering on the brink.
Well, nobody knows how lucky everybody that cares about golf and cares about the tour and plays on the tour, that whoever wrote that letter added those few words. They didn't need to add those words. They were just added, okay?
Yeah.
If the players had simply said, we don't want you to do this, we couldn't have done it if the players were against it.
Yeah, because like you said, it's the tour's owned by the players.
That's correct, yes.
Dean, one of the major things that happened on your watch was the Ping litigation, and you may have to do a little educating for our listeners to take us back to those days in terms of what was the real issue, who initiated what, how did it get resolved, and what's the implications on today's game relative to technology?
Well, the Ping litigation started with my concern and a lot of players' concern about square grooves, that it changed the skills necessary to play golf. When square grooves came in and Ping created the Square Grooves Club, there's no question that you could put more spin on the ball and on iron shots, and particularly wedge shots and out of the rough. It made a huge difference in the performance. I felt, and we did our own, testing. It wasn't particularly sophisticated testing, but their own testing and became convinced that what the players were saying, that it changed the dynamics of play, that was correct. And so we proposed to ban square grooves. Simple. USGA would not do that. USGA stood back because USGA doesn't want the tour or anybody else fooling with the rules. That's a rule.
Yeah.
So they were literally almost on the side of Ping because it was a big battle. And ultimately, we settled with Ping. Our insurance company literally paid him a lot of money for settlement because they knew what it was going to cost them if they settled. They didn't know what it was going to cost them if they didn't settle. But we lost that skirmish, but we won the big battle because in the settlement, Ping agreed that the tour as an entity had the authority to make its own rules. Okay? And part of that was setting up a separate committee to look at those kinds of things that would not have players who might have conflict of interest because of contracts with
managers. Contracts.
Yeah, things like that. But our insurance company paid a lot of money, but the tour came out of that with the specific authority from a manufacturer who agreed that the tour as an entity could make its own rules, that the manufacturer didn't control the rules. We lost the battle. We won the war. Okay.
The suit was brought by Ping in 1989. This subsequent settlement, which, as you say, sort of codified the rules' ability the tour's ability to set their own rules. That agreement happened when, Dean? Was that about 2010?
No. That happened before I retired.
Much sooner. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I retired in 94. It's probably 92 or 93 when that was finalized.
And was that power recognized immediately, or was there a time certain that it would take effect?
No, I don't. There was no time. It was recognized, but it was set aside away from the board to a special committee that would look at that. Let me give you a couple postscripts to that. Number one is my only regret for retiring is that the tour did nothing to follow up on that. Zero. I had contracted with a couple of folks to build super testing equipment so that the unsophisticated tests that we did before could be more accurate and more definitive. So I was moving towards a specific program to ultimately ban those. Okay. People coming after me did nothing. Zero. 10 years later, the USGA started doing its own testing in square grooves. Their testing expert told me once they tested them in a sophisticated way, it's the most provable thing that they've ever done. Hmm. And ultimately, the USGA required square grooves to be modified. Okay? They didn't ban square grooves, but they modified them in a way that they weren't as pervasive as they were before. So the USGA ultimately agreed with what we were trying to do, and ultimately said it was the most provable thing that they've ever done. So those original square grooves were able to be used for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
But the reason that I say that you know, when I retired, I wish I hadn't, okay? Because I never would have let 10 years run before something was done. And I never would have permitted what has now happened with the rest of technology in golf. I might have lost that battle, okay, later on, but I never would have abandoned that battle to try to protect the integrity of the way the game is played. Today, the way the game is completely different than when you and I played, Bruce.
Absolutely.
It's a whole different game. And if the USGA thinks that on short iron shots, in particular, and shots out of the rough, that the original square grooves really altered the way game is played, what are they thinking about the new drivers and the golf balls that are being used that have altered every shot in game and the way the whole game is played?
There's no doubt about it.
I might have lost the job as commissioner as a result. I would never have stood back and not done, tried to do something. And that's the only thing I regret about retiring when I did.
Well, the USGA and the RNA have sat back now for 20 years and they're monitoring. What are they monitoring?
I don't know. I don't know what they're monitoring. It is. It's remarkable to me, that nothing's been done.
Well, you've certainly answered the question that we were about to ask, which would have been.
Yeah, I was about to ask you.
You know, if Dean Beaman was still running the PGA Tour today and had continuously run it, would we be seeing a different game on tour? And I guess your answer is, well, if I had prevailed, we certainly would have.
Yeah.
Yes, that's an accurate. I would have done everything within my power to have prevented what has happened today. You know, what do you think would happen with baseball? Okay, what would you think with baseball if they allowed metal bats
or bigger bats?
And they would kill some pitchers.
Yeah, you'd have some dead
before
pitchers.
They do something. they kill some pitchers. Okay. And what would they do? How would the game of baseball be if a pitcher could work with a manufacturer and design a ball that fit his best stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
Whether he's a curveball pitcher or a fastball, what if he could change the dynamics of the aerodynamics and everything about the baseball so that it fit his best stuff? I mean, goodness gracious sakes. And the crime of it all, let me tell you the crime, and I call it a crime. The crime of it all is that the major organizations in golf, the USGA, the PGA of America, the RNA, they have said, you know, golf has picked up since in the last year or so because of the
COVID.
Okay. But before that, everybody was scared to death about what's happened to the game of golf. Golf courses are being closed, less players. And they've all defined three things that have caused golf to not grow. And that is, it costs too much, okay?
Yep.
It takes too long, and it's too hard to learn, okay? The new equipment that is being out there today, used every day, costs enormously more than equipment. If you matched the rate of inflation with equipment and what it is today, because everybody, all this super technology, and you know, they changed something else, so everybody feels they got to get rid of the clubs that they used to use for 10 years and now can use for 18 months because they got something new. The answer is enormous cost. Because the organizations that run tournaments are trying to protect par, and they've gone from a 9 or 10 speed to a 12 and 13 speed green. Costs three times as much to maintain a 12 green than it does an 8 or 9 green. Three times as much. They got to build new tees. When you build a new golf course, it's got to be 7,600 yards long instead of it used to be 68 or 67 for a championship course. That's money. That's cost. Okay? And when the average player, who this equipment doesn't help very much at all, plays those longer golf courses with faster greens, it takes them longer to play, and it's more difficult for them to play. So all of the things that those organizations say has damaged golf, they've sat by and allowed to happen, and they need to do something.
I agree with you, Dean. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, Bruce and I have actually talked about maybe doing an episode if we can get somebody from the USGA and RNA on to educate the listeners on the issues they're wrestling with, but to also give us a peek at what they believe is likely to occur. I don't know if we'll be able to pull that off or not.
I'd like you to put an organization, a group of people together that would teach them something about intestinal fortitude.
Very good.
There you go. Let me ask you something. It's a bit more of a current thing, and just see what your reaction to it is. This new $40 million player impact program pool that was created to move the brand needle as opposed to shoot a better score.
I don't know much about that at all. I've read about it. Actually, I haven't read about it. I've heard about it. I never read any of the papers about it when it came out. So you may literally know more about it than I do. The scuttlebutt that I heard was because a couple of folks with a pocket full of money were going to try to create a super tour with a few players and try to get these players to leave the tour to do that, or maybe they thought they could hold a few events and the tour would still keep them as members. And, I'm just not into that. I don't understand all the ramifications of that. So I'm not real helpful to you on that.
Certainly seemed like a defensive move against the very move that you were talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a defensive move, but it's another way to pay players that are important to the game. So look at it as a champions tour without having to play. Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's wrong. And a player who loses some of his putting touch and is not as proficient as he was before, but has contributed enormous to the game and still is important to the crowds that watch golf, it very well could be a good idea.
So as you look back on some of the transformative contributions that Dean Beaman has made to the professional game over his 20-year career, we talked about many of them. Some of those we touched on slightly in terms of significantly advancing the tournament management, establishing the Players Council, introducing the at the beginning, the Players' Championship, adding the Tour Championship. You mentioned restructuring the World Series of Golf. We could probably do a whole episode just on the Tournament Players Club.
Interesting thing about the Tournament Players Club in the stadium golf course and stadium golf courses. We'd started that project in 1979. In the early 60s, when I was playing amateur golf, I was involved with a golf course architect named Eddie Ault in and working on a project in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which actually never came about. We did the plan, but the developer never followed through. But while we were together, I happened to be a PGA Tour event in Washington at the time. I believe it was at Congressional Country Club. And I went out to watch the players play. And I couldn't see anything. It was ridiculous. Everybody had a periscope. Yeah. You know, that's the biggest seller. They sold more periscopes than they sold beer on the golf course.
There you go.
I came up with this idea that a golf course for a tournament ought to be built with the fairways down and the greens down, and the areas surrounding should be up as a stadium, and name the concept Stadium Golf. So we came up with some designs, Eddie Alt and I, and went to New York and sat down with Joe Dye. This was in the early 60-61. Sat down with Joe Dye and said to Joe, "Hey, Joe, we've got this idea. The USGA holds your national championships, the Open, the amateur, the ladies. You ought to build 5 or 6 golf courses around the country as stadiums that take care of the spectators for holding all of your tournaments." And at the same time, they were just starting to do the USGA green sections. And I said, you could hold not only your events there, but you could do all your experimentation on grasses and things like that at your own facilities and own them. And you could rotate all your events around those events in the cities where you want to be. And it took him about 3.5 minutes to say it wasn't, didn't think much of the idea, and let's go have lunch. So that was it. So years later, 20 years later, when I had the job of taking the Players Championship and make it into something special, and it is special, took up the concept of Stadium Golf, and we developed that into the TPC at Sawgrass, which is the first Stadium Golf course. But it was 1961 when I came up with that idea.
Interesting. Yeah, it is interesting.
The TPC thing, the way that came about, it seems like you dramatically overpaid for that piece of property, didn't you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, actually, everybody talks about the dollar for that. We didn't pay a dollar for that. I never let him cash the check. I wrote it up and handed it to him and then took it back so I could put it on the wall.
There you go.
What are you most proud of?
You know, that interesting question. What I'm most proud of is doesn't have anything to do with any of these programs that have created huge dollars for charity and for players. I'm most proud that we've been able to transform golf from a minor sport to a major sport, and introduced the ability to raise billions of dollars for both players and local communities. But we've been able to do that without damaging the integrity of the game of golf. We've moved it into the area of big money sports without losing very much of what golf stands for. And golf and golfers respect the rules. They respect the rules officials, and they respect their fellow competitors, and it shows every day in their competition. And so we've been able to move golf into big money without having to give up those attributes that makes golf the best game in the world and far ahead of any other sport.
Let's give you, not as a player, but as a commissioner, one career mulligan. Where would you take the mulligan?
In retiring without solidifying the intrusion of technology that I believe has hurt the game. That may be my mulligan.
Yeah. The things you just related to seem to me to be characteristics of the game that we'd probably like to hope would be preserved in the game, let's say in 50 years. And so for our listeners that perhaps are listening to this historic podcast 50 years hence, what would you hope the game would look like when they're listening to this in 50 years?
I would hope that they look at the game like it was back in the 70s before technology, I believe, that invaded the game and has done nothing to advance the sport for the average player.
I'd just like to have you wrap up with reflecting back on how you'd like to be remembered both as a player and as a commissioner of the PGA Tour.
Well, I you know, as a player, I'd like to be remembered as somebody who was a fair competitor, but a competitor. Hopefully, people would look at me and say that regardless of your stature, you, with enough hard work, you can excel. As a commissioner, I generally look at things as how they could be, not as how they are. And I truly believe that the human mind is a goal-seeking mechanism. And if you set the goals and have the courage to follow those goals, that a high percentage of time you'll reach those goals. And I set a high standard for where I wanted golf and the PGA Tour to be when I became commissioner. And I believe that the commissioners that have followed me, Fincham and now Jay Monahan, have taken that foundation and have eclipsed anything that I've done, and I'm proud of them.
Dean, we just want to say again, thank you so much for being with us today. I know a lot of people are going to get a lot of very interesting information from the podcast today, and Mike and I are thrilled to have you with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Looking back over the years where the tour has continued to progress and benefit the communities where the events are held, benefit the players, and I think instilled in corporate America, mostly those corporate American companies who have supported the tour have found the value of contributing not just to their bottom line, but to the communities that make it possible for them to be successful. And that's been the formula for the success of the tour. And I believe it's going to continue to be the formula for success of every company, that you can't just be looking at your bottom line and how much money you make. It's how good is your product and how can you contribute to your community in making yourself successful.
Dean, it's been a pleasure having you today, telling your story for the good of the game. We really appreciate it.
That's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.